evening, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. It's a great blessing for us to welcome Nayaswami Asha here in Delhi. And Asha, as most of you know, she and her husband David are the spiritual directors of our largest city community and ashram in America in Palo Alto, California. And she's had that position for many years. But above all, Asha has a wonderful way of sharing and is one of the leading speakers and teachers of Ananda Sangha. I met Asha for the first time 41 years ago, and she was one of the first people at Ananda Sangha I met when I came. And from that first moment, she's been an inspiration, an example, but also a dear friend. And Asha's topic this evening is letting go and letting God. Many, many times in those 41 years, I've come to Asha with some question or some problem, and more often than not, her advice has been, let go and let God. You know, let go of what you think is this terrible problem and open your heart to God and let God come in and share it with Him and make your life a joint effort with God. And we can find that those big problems really are nothing at all. And so I welcome her.
When Keshava makes reference to those 41 years ago, I actually vividly remember it. Ananda was one community in one place, and it was barely that. It was, it was probably about where Pune is now. Maybe a little behind or ahead, I'm not sure, but essentially where Pune is now. And I was cooking in the kitchen of this dome that we built that leaked like a sieve in the winter, and the water heater would freeze over and should have been torn down. We cooked in it for 25 years before it was torn down. And Keshava came, and he had flaming carrot red hair all the way down to here, wildly curly, you know, sometimes pulled back in a ponytail. He was a character.
I can tell stories.
Yeah, I know. You'll have your day after I leave town. I liked him immediately. He's right. We immediately became friends. And it's 41 years sounds like a long time. I was saying this last when I was in Calcutta two nights ago. And it sounds like a really long time. And then we were both in our early 20s. Dia wasn't even an imaginary thought yet. My husband David was nowhere on the horizon. It was just a whole different world. And if we had, I don't know what we would have thought if we said in 2013 they would be having a center in Delhi and I would come to visit. I'm not sure whether we would have believed it or just laughed ourselves sick at the funny thought of it. But what the real point is, and it's even related to my topic, we never really worried about anything. I think the salient quality of those early years, we were living very strongly in the aura of Swami Kriyananda. I wouldn't say more strongly than now. In fact, in many ways, I would say less strongly, but more directly because he was physically present. I mean, we were in our 20s, so he was in his 40s. He was just, you know, when you see the frail man being helped out to sit down, but as soon as he sits down, the power that comes out of him, well, he had that all through his body then too. The body was the same power as the voice and the spirit. And we hadn't, I think to say we hadn't the faintest idea of what we'd gotten ourselves into would probably be accurate. He had this vision of what Ananda was and where it was going to go. I actually remember sitting on the porch of his little dome where he lived in that very early year, and he talked about, and we were, bear in mind, just think if the Pune community, which some of you have been to but not all, in its very, very, let's use the word simple stage of development, was the only, absolutely the only thing about Ananda that existed. And there was nothing else anywhere. And then he told us that eventually we'd build in Europe, and then after Europe, perhaps Australia, and then after Australia, we'd come to India. We did go to Australia. It kind of fizzled out there, but we tried, and then come to India. I remember him saying, too, these are all things you hear as a very inexperienced young person. He said, India will be more receptive if they can be part of an international work instead of just being invaded by Americans, was the word he used. So that's why he thought we should go to Europe first and Australia first and then finally come to India, because after all, this is where it all started. And I remember him just sort of saying all that, and there was so few of us and so little evidence that any of that would come to be. But there was so much spiritual dynamism in Swami Kriyananda always that it was, if he said so, why not? And so much of a feeling of the presence of the masters and such a conviction of the importance of what we had, but not important in the sense of, oh, we're master's disciples and we have this, you know, important in the eyes of the world thing to do. But it was so important because of what it meant to each of us. You know, every seeker has that moment when the answer to his quest is revealed to him. Whether it's revealed slowly and one immerses oneself gradually and then only maybe after a while sort of realizes what you have and where you are. I liken it, if you, let's just say, you have an arranged marriage and only after a few years do you realize what a good deal you've gotten in your marriage because you didn't know each other at the start, or you fall in love right away. It happens all kinds of ways. But at a certain point, you understand what you have. And so the importance that we felt profoundly even in those early days. Now, every time I say this, I keep seeing you there with your beautiful red hair, the envy of all the women. we'll find pictures. we were so poor, and Keshava was always impeccably attired. He had the karma to always look fabulous no matter what. Even, you know, even when he was just a hippie with long hair, he was a really classy hippie. That's what I keep seeing in my mind. what I was saying, which was more important than that, but I got distracted by all those mental pictures. It was important because we knew how much it could change the life of each individual for no other reason than we knew what it had done for us. You know, we were deeply sincere in our spiritual path. We were not terribly focused or clear-minded yet, but that's just a question of time. What really matters is the heart. What really matters is that soul recognition. And there was such a profound soul recognition and just the complete realization that, you know, whether it was reading autobiography, meeting Swami Kriyananda, receiving Kriya initiation, whatever, wherever it happened, that nothing would ever be the same again. And also the understanding that, you know, this was the culmination not just of one incarnation of seeking, but, you know, many lifetimes leading up to this point. So when Swamiji would tell us that this will be a worldwide movement that will, you know, be dispersing all over the globe, that in time hundreds, then thousands, and tens of thousands of people will come, even though there was not a shred of physical evidence that such a thing could ever happen, you know, we were struggling to pay the monthly mortgage. But there wasn't just a certainty about it. That if Swamiji said it, it's happened, we could understand how it would happen. Now, Swamiji put me in front of people to speak pretty early on. It was obviously my destiny, and he wanted me to work the kinks out of it pretty early, so he just got me started right away. And also, I have Swami described himself in this way, and it also describes me. He said about himself, he has a very enthusiastic nature, and therefore anything that he enjoys, he wants everyone else to enjoy. In another context, very sweetly, when a radio interviewer asked him, as a man who's given his life to a certain cause, it's a natural thing to see a person at the end of their life who's given their life to a cause, and you ask the question, has it been worth it to you? Has it made you happy? And Swami answered that in a very sophisticated way. His first response was, well, if you ask people if they're happy, almost everyone is afraid to admit that they're not, so they'll say, yes, I'm happy. He said, but what a person says is not the final proof of what their consciousness really is. He said, the proof of happiness is that you want everyone in the world to be as happy as you are. And that's especially true, of course, when you're dealing with a spiritual reality, because it's Sat Chit Ananda. It's that ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. And what was the intention of God when he made creation? He wanted to experience his bliss through all. As Swami often points out, he's not experiencing his bliss through very many, but nonetheless, that's the intention of it. And when we ourselves are touched by that deep spirituality, the desire to share it is really the first thing that comes. And saints, more than any others, recognize that what they have is for everyone. Now, so in that sense, where I was speaking, with Swamiji, you know, asked me to start sharing very early, and I always felt from the first, my introduction to this path was directly through Swami Kriyananda. I own the autobiography of a yogi, but I didn't find it interesting, interestingly enough, until after I met Swami Kriyananda. It's like I needed an intermediary between Yogananda, between Master and me, and Swami Kriyananda provided that. And as soon as I met him, literally as soon as he walked into the room, 1969, I didn't have the phrase, oh, he's my guru, I'm his disciple. It wasn't exactly like that, although in retrospect, that's what you would say. But I recognized that he had what I wanted. He had a consciousness that I wouldn't have been able to describe until I saw it. And as soon as I saw it, I recognized it as my own. And I don't mean just my own in the sense that, in truth, he belonged to me and I belonged to him. But that the consciousness he had was the consciousness that I had always been seeking. I would call it now, first I would call it bliss, and second I would call it freedom. I wouldn't have thought of myself as not being free, but when I saw freedom, I recognized it. And freedom, by this I mean the freedom to choose that which you know to be right in all circumstances. And I was a young girl just tossed about by so many different desires. And sometimes I would be able to live according to high ideals, and sometimes my ideals would just crash around my head and I didn't have a chance. And at the same time, I knew that there was a straight line that was possible to follow, but I didn't have any idea how to follow it. And Swamiji walked into the room, and when he was a younger man, he was so upright, and his chest was always uplifted, and it was sort of like he moved through the world heart first. And he walked very fast. It was hard for us to keep up with him, and he was always had, you know, just this huge energy field going around him that wasn't merely just the spiritual power. It was the the fact that he had this work to do for Master, and there was nothing on this earth that was going to stop him from doing that. And that, the, what I call freedom was that commitment that was not going to be turned aside. And when I think about it more subtly now, also, of course, Master was right behind him, pushing him. And so the power and the freedom of that was because he wasn't alone. And I myself was a dynamic person, even as a young person. I could make a lot of things happen, relatively speaking, in my tiny world. I was 22 years old. I hadn't had much of an opportunity to prove myself. But in the tiny little things that I tried to do, I had a certain amount of force. But it was always lucky for me if it worked. At least that's how I felt inside. I mean, I had a certain talent. I had a way with words. I had a certain chutzpah. You know the word chutzpah? It just means like a kind of brash confidence that's really not based on anything real. I had that solidly. But the result of that was not freedom. The result of that was a really deep underlying anxiety, because there was never any clarity as to why things would work or fail. I didn't know. I had already begun to learn. I started when I was 18 learning about karma and reincarnation and to a certain extent about the how the world works and why from a divine point of view. I was studying Vivekananda's writings, and of course he was very cogent and told me a great deal. But it was beautiful intellectual ideas that I knew were much more than beautiful intellectual ideas, but I couldn't get them into me. And I knew it was theoretically possible to have them inside of me, but until Swami walked in the room, I didn't know what that looked like. And I became, well, I was enthralled, absolutely enthralled. Plus, more than that, it was in truth the answer to a desperate prayer. Like, you know, I was very quietly hysterical, although those sound like contradictory terms, because I just didn't have any idea how I was going to live in this world. Because I didn't know how to function. I was using the word freedom. I just didn't know where power came from. I didn't know where certainty came from. I didn't know where love came from. I had some of those things, but I had no context for them. So I just followed Swami. He was at Ananda Village. He was starting this community. It took me about a year before I could unravel my personal situation enough to get up there. 1971, June 1st, Tuesday morning. I got word that it was auspicious to arrive before noon on Tuesday, so I did. Swami actually sent word, make sure that she arrives on Tuesday morning before noon, so I did. But let me come back to what I was saying. But then I just became his devotee and really wanted to know. Now, nowadays, Swamiji will remark, oh yes, I've written 150 books. It was 149 until 2 weeks ago. Now it's 150. In 8 days, he wrote another book. Just had a little time on his hands, so why not? So he wrote one more. He did all the music. He's founded all these communities, everything like that. And you just sort of, you know, his accomplishments are unreal. And he'll say, oh, it was very easy to do. He said, I didn't do any of it. He said, God and Guru just acted through me, Master acted through me. And he just says it so casually. Just like, and then he'll tell us, oh, it's not hard. You just focus at the spiritual eye and then you bring into the light whatever it is that you want to do, and then it'll be given to you and you'll do it. And he's not being flippant when he says that. And he's not even just being humble when he says that. Oh, no, don't look at me. You know, I haven't really accomplished anything. As Swami calls it, backing into the limelight. You know, like that. Not at all. He's actually just telling us the truth. And what's been so interesting about my years with Swamiji, and I've written some of it, I've written a book about him, which I hope I will call, I've written one book about him, I hope it's not my last. No, it's not the last book I'll write about him. Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, it's stories of my experiences and others. So some of what I'm going to say is in that book. Excuse me a moment. But what I've learned about him, which is so fascinating, at first I admired him because his behavior is correct. His response to people is correct. And I try to make my behavior correct, and I try to make my response to people correct. And I apply myself to that. I try to be calm. I try not to be reactive. I try not to jump to instant decisions. I have a very quick mind, and I've noticed something that's really fun. Usually, your worst quality is your best quality, just taken a little too far. Watch that in yourself and others. So I have this quality of being able to put my thoughts into words. That's the gift that God has given me. Whatever I can think, I can also articulate. Gives the impression that I know more, but that isn't true. I can just say everything that's in my head. But the downside of that is some of those thoughts should not be articulated. Sometimes you think things that would be better left unsaid, but I also say those. So I work at it, and I've worked hard for many years, and I'm much nicer than I was when I met Keshava 41 years ago. I always had a good heart, but now I'm a nicer person. So all of that, I'm proud is not the right word, but I'm very gratified to see that enormous amount of change is possible. So when I would see Swami Kriyananda behaving in certain ways, I would just imagine, I would define him by my own experience. I mean, what can we do? You can only understand to the limit of your own experience. What the saints and masters come to show us is how puny our experience is. And what is really possible. And I'm going to tell you one story, which is in the book, but I'll share it anyway. There was a couple in the community, and they, were married by choice. We don't have arranged marriages in America as a rule. And they were very ill-suited for one another, and their marriage didn't last very long. And when they were separating, we were at the dinner table with Swami Kriyananda and a small group of people, including a woman named Seva, who was one of his earliest students with whom he worked every single day at that time for, 15 or 20 years. Every day they would work together. And she was a very fine-looking person. She had beautiful brown eyes. That was her most notable key features, these warm, beautiful eyes. And I made some remark about this woman and that we had gone shopping for a birthday present for her husband. I suggested a certain shirt that would match his eyes, and she didn't know what color his eyes were. I found that just amazing. Haven't you ever looked at him? But she didn't, and she thought, oh, that will match his eyes, oh, that's good. So I just made that remark, just casually, like dinner table conversation. It wasn't perhaps the nicest thing to have said, but I said it. And Swamiji just listened. He was interested. He didn't criticize me for gossiping or anything. He just listened. But after the whole conversation was over, he had this slightly questioning look on his face. And I sort of drew him out on it because I knew him well enough to know that there was something behind that. He said, I have no idea what color people's eyes are. He said, I never look at their eyes. He said, I always look into their eyes. And then Seva, who was sitting next to him, who he'd seen every day for almost 20 years, he looked at her and he sort of peered at her, kind of like that. And he said, oh, your eyes are brown. And then it suddenly just takes the whole story and takes it somewhere else. It's like I was trying to have good behavior. Swamiji is driven to have right consciousness. Because if you have right consciousness, your behavior automatically follows. And yes, both are good. It's very good to restrain your bad impulses. It's very good to try to manifest the right energy and attitude when you can. But the real way to shift is to shift our consciousness so we are just simply perceiving another reality. And this is, of course, where all spiritual practice is enormously benefited by meditation, especially the practice of Kriya, or something that is very effective like Kriya, which actually takes you into another dimension where you perceive a reality very different from this one. So even though we come back completely and live in this world and carry on with our families and our duties and our work, the confines of this world, the boundaries of this world have been greatly expanded when we know that. Swamiji has recently, I think it was book number 149, was the book of the commentaries on the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, which I happened to be, when I first arrived in India, I had 3 days in Bangalore with nothing to do. And I was in a room with a copy of the Patanjali commentary, which really turned out to be God-given. I didn't realize how much I just needed to stop. Of course, when you leave on an 8-week trip, as I did, you have to do all that 8 weeks of work in the time before you leave. And so it was just to stop. But it was also such a God-given opportunity that it happened to be that particular book. It's not published yet in America, which is one of the reasons I grabbed it to read it. You are so lucky here. Sangeeta gets those books out so fast. We're 6 months, 9 months later, we're still waiting for the books in America. I don't mean to cast any aspersions. There's a recording. I don't mean to cast any aspersions on the American Publishing Company. It's just easier to get them out fast in this country. But the whole theme of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which Swamiji just pulled out perfectly, the sutras are like, they're like condensed milk, just way. Those desserts that you make where you boil the milk for hours and hours and the big pot of milk just gets down to its absolute essence and every spoonful is delicious. That's what Patanjali did with the spiritual path. It's just boiled way down. And it's boiled down to one point. At least that's how I felt when I kept reading it over and over. Because we live in these physical bodies, because we identify, because the infinite spirit that is truly us identifies with this physical body, we are always confused as to what is really happening in this world. We think that what happens to this body is really happening to us. And we think that the characteristics of this body are really our own characteristics. It was also an extremely apt moment for me, because I have been teaching for many years, I've also been coming to India for many years, but I've never put the two together. This is a new reality for me, and to travel through this country and share Master's teachings. And halfway through my 2 months, it's just been a fabulous experiment. I've loved every minute of it. But when I first started 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was acutely aware of the fact that I live in this body. That's the only way I could say it. Just, the definition of this body and all the cultural memories associated with it and the life experience was intruding on my ability to relate just in terms of consciousness, which is what we're all really trying to do. And so I had so many opportunities to reflect, even just on that little fact of Swamiji's. Why would I look at people's eyes? What can a person's physical pupils tell me about them? Nothing. Just the body they're inhabiting now. And what does that really have to do with anything that actually matters? But of course, our consciousness radiates out through our eyes. I've watched Swamiji in company. He'll be introduced to someone and he'll look at them and he'll be gracious and he'll shake hands like that. And then like a split second later or a couple of seconds later, he'll actually recognize you. And he'll recognize you because of the consciousness, the enduring soul. He'll shake hands with the body, he'll look at the face, and then all of a sudden he recognizes the soul, either the soul qualities or the individual from another lifetime or another place. And just a whole different level of recognition comes into it. Now, let's see, I had one more story in that. Oh, yes, I remember this one. In the same way about not identifying, when I came to Swami, I was 22. I mean, I worked with him very closely for many years, about a decade, and then I got shuffled off into something else, but I've always stayed very closely connected. And then I got old enough to be 25 years older than the people I was working with. And all of a sudden, I had a little perspective on what Swami Priyananda's experience had been. And I remembered vividly that never once in all the years that I had worked with him had he ever referred to my physical age or to my inexperience, even though I believe a less patient person would have been tempted, let's put it that way. And I thanked him for that. When I realized it, I thanked him. I said, "Sir, I realize you never ever referred to my age or, you know, made me feel that I didn't have something to contribute because I didn't have the same experience you did." Just a few words like that. But especially about the age really struck me. And he kind of took what I said graciously, but there was a look on his face, so I waited for the rest of it. And then he said, just simply, "I never noticed." "Oh." He said, "I never think of people in terms of their physical age." He said, "Not even children. I mean, children are not children. They were ancient souls before they were children." A little 8-year-old girl once came up to Swami Kriyananda. She couldn't figure him out. You know, a child's brain is a lot more fluid because he looked old. She got that. But he didn't seem old at all. And she just stared at him. She was a very serious child. She stared at him like this. And finally just said, "How old are you anyway?" Just like that. And then he looked at her in a kind of bemused way. He said, "Let's put it this way." He said, "When you were an old woman, I was a little boy." And the child sort of held that for a moment, and then sort of it clicked in for her, and she walked away quite satisfied. I think that they had been. She'd been an old woman, he'd been a little boy, and that's the last time they saw each other. I think that was part of it. But you see, you don't have to work at those things if you work at changing your consciousness. So our topic this evening, which I've been, you know, floating around, letting go and letting God, it's not something that you can take and impose on your life. You're absolutely terrified about the outcome of something. You're gripping it with both hands. You're desperately trying to bring about a certain result, and then all of a sudden in that somehow you're supposed to let go and let God. It's not a chance. You know, it's just, there's not a chance. The practice of really allowing God to run your life has to be not in the desperate moment, now I'll pray. It has to be a constant effort to completely redefine everything. That might sound harder, but that's actually much easier. It's every time we move through life, every time we do anything, we ask ourselves, you know, who am I? What am I doing here? How have I defined my reality? Travel, I mean, one of the benefits of travel is it's dual. It has a dual reality. One is my friend Brian, who's back there on the camera, he and I have been traveling around together a bit. Brian used to be a child. And I've known him since before he was born, as I put it. And he grew up in our community, and now he's a grown man. And so here's somebody that used to be a child in my life, and now he's a much bigger person than I, happily carrying my luggage for me and helping make recordings and all of this. And we're two Americans. Sometimes we've been by ourselves, you know, in India. And it's like, are we? You know, are you a man? Am I a woman? Am I an American? Are you an American? Are these people Indian? Are we all just in this together? And travel is really fun, especially, I mean, we've been together the last few days, but both of us have also traveled a lot solitary. Just completely by yourself sometimes. Just walking down the street by yourself, alone in your house, wherever you are. What am I identifying with in this moment? Where is my energy? Where are my ideas coming from? Do I live my life in such a way as to constantly reinforce the most limited aspects of myself? Or am I living my life in a way to reinforce the most expanded aspects of myself? And if we really want to shift our consciousness, if we really want to be able to be like Swami is and just really honestly say, no, of course I didn't do it. I was able to accomplish it because God was working through me. That doesn't just happen all of a sudden. That happens because on a moment-to-moment basis, I'm upset because somebody spoke rudely to me. So we have to stop and ask ourselves the question, first of all, what difference does it make if they spoke rudely to me? Who's upset? Who's been insulted? And if I've been insulted, what difference does that make? What am I identifying with that all of a sudden the fact that somebody didn't speak nice to me makes such a big difference to me? Even if my head hurts today, is it really my head that hurts? Or is it just the head I happen to be wearing that hurts? It's like every minute of every day, we are either affirming or letting go of our limited realities. It's a very great benefit on the spiritual path, interestingly enough, to do creative work. Because when we do creative work, or when we work creatively, it doesn't matter if your work is creative, but if you work creatively, we're always trying to attune ourselves to something that hasn't happened before. That's what real creativity is. When we're also, real creativity is not just to be different. Well, I'll use the word originality. To be creative is to be original. To be original is to act from your point of origin. That's a marvelous definition if you start thinking about what creativity really means. It means to be original, which is to act from your point of origin. Now, the fascinating thing about that is you can do exactly what everyone else has done. And Swamiji uses the example of saying to someone that you really care about, I love you. And, I mean, really, that is about the corniest line that there is. Everybody's heard that line. But when you actually speak it from your point of origin, it's a completely original and creative remark in that moment. But if you're speaking it merely as a cliche from the outside, it has no power to change anything. So when we move through life, we have to ask ourselves, what level of myself is acting? What level of myself? Because all of these are ourselves. It's not like the ego doesn't exist. It's not like the needs of the body don't exist. It's not like the identification with family and the responsibilities that have given to us don't exist. But it's a question of where they fit in the proportion of our lives. You know, am I only this? Or am I always a greater field of consciousness moving through this reality? That's why Swami Kriyananda, when people understood him less, I would say when he kept a veil over his consciousness is the only way I can describe it. For many, many years, partly because he was in America and in the late 60s and all through the 70s, it was a pretty wacky time spiritually in America. There were a lot of self-proclaimed gurus coming over from India. There were a lot of really confused, often drug-inspired young people running around trying to be disciples of self-declared gurus. And it was pretty much of a circus. It was just, and Swami didn't want to have anything to do with that. Besides which, he is a true spiritual master, and he is the disciple of a great master, and so he didn't need to assert that kind of reality. His power was the power that just emanated. He didn't have to force it out or pretend. It just was there. But he kept a bit of a veil over it because he wanted sincere people, is what I would say. And he didn't want people who were there for the show. So he kept it veiled. Now, I had a point in saying that. Let me think what I wanted to say for that. Oh, yes. But at the same time, he would talk about himself sometimes, especially about his ability to accomplish things. And people would get very confused as to whether he was egoless or egotistical. But if you were sensitive, and God knows there were many of us who were, because any great teacher, no matter how great the teacher, has those who understand him and those who don't. And even those who are against him, that's just the way it is. If there's that much light, there's always a counter force to it. But he would just talk about all the things he had done. He would just, you know, he would give us satsang and he would just give us a summary of the last 2 months and the books he'd written and the music he's written and this thing that he'd accomplished and that thing that he'd accomplished. And I would always wonder, like, what is he doing? But what he was trying to help us to understand is, that which I do, ye shall do also, and greater things. That's how Jesus put it just before he left, before he was crucified. He said that what I have done is just you. It's not special to me. It's that I have simply allowed the divine force to flow through. And all of you can do this. Swami described himself many times. One specific moment was when he said, I never identify with Swami Kriyananda. He said, I consider Swami Kriyananda an event for which I am responsible. I've always loved that. You know, like you have to put on a party. And so you have to be very conscientious. You have to get the food, the decorations, the flowers, the invitations. You have to make sure it's a good night, that the music is there. I mean, there's lots and lots of details. And if you're responsible and you want it to come out right, you have to put a tremendous amount of energy out to make it just exactly what it should be. But you would be a little loony if you thought that you actually were the party that you were giving. It's just an event for which you are responsible. And Swamiji speaks of himself. I mean, we inhabit this body and this personality, exactly the person that we are. We're just this one cycle. I had a fabulous dream once. I say fabulous. I was extremely, if you can be proud of yourself for not having an ego, I was proud because I didn't show much ego in this story. It's a contradiction. It's oxymoronic to be proud of yourself for being egoless or being detached is actually the right word. I had this crazy dream in which a friend of mine was going to cut my head off. And we were just sort of in this open area, and it was very gothic. There was like this big sort of rock, and he had an axe, like a battle axe from the Middle Ages or something like that, big pole with this huge blade on the end. And he was just a friend of mine, and we both knew that it was just my time to die, and so he was going to cut my head off. And when it came time, you know, I just kind of laid my head on the block like that, and just like a cartoon, you know, he picked up this big battle axe to chop my head off, and I was very relaxed. And then, just at the last second, it crossed my mind that this might hurt. And I became, just for a second, I was a little concerned that this might hurt. But I also knew, well, whatever it feels, it's not going to last very long. But I remembered, I didn't remember in the dream, but I know that Master said that when the soul sees that something is going to happen to the body, that the soul doesn't want to experience, it will withdraw just before it happens. So that, like if you're people who have these out-of-body experiences often describe that. They see the two cars coming for the head-on collision, but before it strikes, they're lifted out of their bodies. There's a remarkable story about Edgar Cayce, who was an American psychic who used to go into trance and read people's past lives. And he was in a building, and there, an elevator door opened. It was about the sixth or seventh floor, and it was heading down. The elevator doors opened, and it was what he needed. And he started to step in, and then suddenly he just, without having any conscious thought, he was just repelled, and he stepped back. The doors closed. The cable broke. The elevator went to the ground, and everyone was killed. I mean, it just happened like that. And as that happened, he realized that no one in the elevator had an aura. You know, he was so used to seeing the light field around people, he thought it as normal. But no one in the elevator had an aura. In other words, their souls had already withdrawn from their bodies because they all knew that their lives were ending in seconds from that moment. And it looked so unnatural to him that he just stepped back without even cognizing it. Isn't that something? Now, that tells us, among millions of other things, why are we always so worried about everything? There's this other force that's really running the show. Well, back to my dream. Just in the moment when I began to be concerned that when the axe came down and cut my head off, it might hurt, my soul withdrew from my body in the dream. And I just started shooting up into the air. And then I looked down and I saw my friend still there. I couldn't clearly see what had happened to my body. It was a huge empty stage. And there was just the two of us right in the center. Then I just watched it, looking down, and I said this, "Bye-bye, Asha." Just like that, just like a little child, "Bye-bye." I was so happy when I woke up, you know? Just like, I'm not a fearless person by a big long shot. I get really nervous when I go to the dentist. You know, it's just like, I don't have that kind of detachment on an everyday basis. But it was very, very gratifying to sort of see that even in my subconscious state, that at such a moment, if the whole thing is taken away, you just say, "Bye-bye," that's it. Now, we don't get there all at once. We get there moment by moment by moment by letting go of what we're so deeply identified with, and just literally identifying ourselves with a greater reality. I am an event. It's not going very well right now, but let me see what I can do to make it go better. You know, these people are not liking me very much right now, but what can I do to make it go better? And then to just realize that we're just a bubble on the sea, that we're just a leaf on the river, that we're just living one incarnation of which we've had so many that we can't even begin to count. And even more profoundly, that when this one is over, I was talking to a friend of mine recently who's been through, you know, just in a human personality way, he's had some, you know, really big time disappointments. The kind of disappointments that they're hard to recover from and they make you sad, really sad. So he's been really sad for a while. And when you're grief-stricken, you know, you kind of have to run the story often quite a few times. But then, not too long ago, I was talking to him, and he started talking to me about what he's learning. And it didn't make him less sad. This was what was so interesting. He was still sad, because when you're hurt, you're hurt. So he was sad, but simultaneously he was talking about changes in consciousness. And what you have to realize is, even if what's going on is difficult, if you change your consciousness, circumstances will always shift. But when you change your consciousness, that's real. That's the one thing that you have for all eternity. And no matter how much you've struggled and either how triumphant or embarrassingly disappointing your entire life has been, if in the midst of it your consciousness expands, your commitment to a greater reality expands, above all, your self-definition expands, then when all of this is just gone from you forever, you will always have that. That's what we have to ask ourselves. I used to be a more emotional person. By the grace of God, I outgrew it. And I used to cry a lot. Not a lot, but things could make me cry much more. It's much harder for me to cry now. Now I cry for, you know, things that touch my heart. But I used to cry in self-pity is what I used to cry. So when something happened once, Swami scolded me very sternly for something that I needed to be scolded for. And then he looked at me like this and he said, "And don't cry," like that. So for like 2 days, I had to hold my eyes open like that. You know, just sort of all the time I was walking like that. But I didn't cry. And I've hardly ever cried in that way since. In that way of, "Oh, poor me, I'm so weak, this is so disappointing, I try so hard." And somewhere in that cycle, something happened that upset me, and I was at home, and I stretched out on my bed on my back, and I was going to start to cry. And I thought, you know, you'll cry for a while, then you'll get finished crying, then you'll get up, and then you'll just go about your day, and you'll be kind of tired, and your eyes will be all red. I said, why don't you just not bother? And I just got up. Because, like, why identify so deeply? I wasn't, you know, denying my feelings or suppressing my feelings. It was just like, there's a bigger world than this. And that's the world of the divine. That's letting go of this, you know, incarnation's old commitment to limitation and simply embracing what has always been there. What's so amazing about that shift is that it appears to be so difficult, but in fact, it isn't hard at all. What's really hard, there's these like Jules Verne books and old science fiction things where people would get into a diving bell and they'd go way down deep into the ocean, or there'd be movies about submarines, which are always really hard to watch because they take place in really small spaces and they're hard to see. But the adventure of a submarine movie is always, of course, that when the trouble comes, the submarine is at the bottom of the ocean. And there's all this ocean pouring down, and of course the drama is when the holes start happening and the ocean starts trying to break in, everybody's trying to hold the ocean at bay like this. I mean, just tremendous, goes on and on and on until the movie finally ends or you turn it off. Okay? But that's what it is to keep this limited ego going. There's the extraordinary pressure all around us of divine love trying to break through and just crack apart. And we're desperately, with just this tremendous sense of survival, which is utterly misplaced, trying to hold that at bay and protect this little world of I, me, mine, my feelings, my desires, my expression, my this, my that. But once we just realize that this is confusion, this is not wisdom. The paradox of this is, let me give you one more thought and then I'll be mostly done. In order to get on the spiritual path, you have to develop a certain amount of that kind of will. Because, you know, there's a nice group in this room, about the right size group for this room, but there's a lot more people in this city, aren't there, than this. And at least some of them, you know. But most people aren't thinking about realizing God. Most people aren't, it never crosses their mind that they should let go of all these identities. They're out there affirming them, enjoying them, having their personal power, doing all these other things. And it takes a certain originality for it even to cross your mind that maybe I really want to take my life in another direction. And that's what Swami Kriyananda was. Wow, this man has actually done it. It was the first one I'd ever seen who had actually done it. I mean, it was just, you know, well, it was life transforming in an instant, literally. It was stunning. But for all of us, but then I had to also, and had already done some work before that, to separate myself from what my parents thought I was going to do, from what society thought I was going to do, from what my school principal thought I was going to do, to even what my younger self had thought I was going to do. You know, I was going to get married and have 6 or 10 children. That was my plan, something like that. I didn't get married for a very long time, and I never had children. Happily. I know sometimes Indian women look at me and, oh, poor baby. No, no, it was fine. I never asked God for a baby, and he never sent me one. We were just fine together. I had other things to do. But I had lots of ideas about what I was going to do with my life. And there was a lot of society pressure on me to do those things, just the way that the world works. And I had to have enough strength to just look at all of that and say, no, I'm not. That's not me. It's not where my happiness lies. And you have to displease people. In that book about Swami, Swamiji asked a certain task of a young man once, and he answered, but my mother would be very disappointed if I did that. Swami answered, we must be prepared to disappoint our mothers, is what he said. He worded it very carefully. We must be prepared to disappoint our mothers. In other words, at a certain point, you have to declare that God is calling me to this reality. And it takes a lot of personal force to do that. But then that personal force can become a habit. And that's what I was saying earlier about sometimes our vices are our virtues carried too far. So there comes a point on the spiritual path where all that force that was going to, I was going to do it my way, has to suddenly understand that my way is not worth it anymore. It's taken me as far as I can take it, and now I have to let go of that way of accomplishing and relax into this completely other way of accomplishing, which is in partnership, in companionship, merely as an instrument for. And it's not always an easy transition or obvious how it works, but it's not as difficult as you think either, because you're suddenly going with the current. When you start feeling, and this is, someone wrote to Swamiji once and said, you know, sir, no matter how I pray, I keep asking God what he wants me to do, and I don't know which of these choices is the one God wants me to follow. Swami's answer was so interesting. He said, follow either one. God is pleased merely that you asked. You know, sometimes we think it's the details that matter. It isn't really. It's the inner attitude, you see. It's the consciousness. Okay, Lord, this is the only thing I can think of to do right now, so let's just do it. Let's do this together. Let, you know, inspire me as we go through. Let me be an instrument. Let even just my little mundane tasks, let me do them as if I was doing them for you. I had an experience when I was working in the kitchen when Keshava would come in and help wash dishes, which is what I recall mostly that he did. At that time, Swami Kriyananda would give Sunday service at our retreat every other Sunday. And I was the cook, and then the whole community was maybe 50 people, would stay afterwards for lunch. On the Sundays when Swamiji was giving Sunday service, I would plan the meal really carefully. I'd spend hours cooking. I'd do the very best I could do. On the days when he wasn't there, oh, any old thing would do, and I'd just put it out there. And after a couple of months of that, it occurred to me that I don't think that Swamiji would be very pleased if he knew what I was doing. Because, yes, I was willing to expand my awareness for his sake, but he wasn't looking for that. He was looking for me to expand my awareness for my own sake. In other words, to see myself always, if I'm serving God, why would I serve him less? Why would he be less present in this circumstance? And above all, what I began to feel is that it was I had far less fun when I wasn't cooking for Swamiji. And at first I thought it was because Swami wasn't there. But then I realized it was because I wasn't opening myself in the same way to be a channel for grace. And I thought, this is not serving me. What to speak of all those poor people who had to eat those meals. But this isn't serving me. At all times, let me identify myself with the largest reality that I can find, do the best that I can do to please God. And in that way, over time, in the most remarkable way, your life just becomes something else entirely. Just becomes so different you can't even recognize yourself. Thankfully, you really don't even know who you are. And then when Swami says things like, just put it to the spiritual eye and ask God to help you, maybe you don't know exactly what he means, but you know a lot more. And that's really worth everything. So, my friends, do we have any thoughts or questions that you'd like to ask? Yes.
You had said that when we start to practice Kriya, we perceive a different reality. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that a bit?
When we start to practice Kriya, we perceive a different reality. Well, the very act of meditation, even without Kriya, initiation, you're cutting your... See, we get our self-definition almost entirely through our senses, through identification with the body. We identify with the body, and then we experience the world wherever that body is. I saw a friend of mine, his daughter was born. I was there for the birth. The baby had a little respiratory distress, and they took the little girl immediately off to just make sure she was okay, which she was. Her father went with her, and I went with the father. He's a great big man. The little baby was, 2 minutes old, little girl, 2 minutes old. She immediately just reached up and took her father's hand, just these tiny little fingers gripping his great big hand, which, of course, it was so touching and so absolutely dear. And at the same time, to me, it was horrifying. She hasn't even been out of the womb 2 minutes, and she's already reaching for things in the world, She's already in her body, and she's trying to see what she can get and experience. Why don't you just be content in yourself just for, 30 more seconds? But it wasn't meant to be. So we just are like that all the time, and if we're not actually grabbing and experiencing, we're thinking about what we're going to experience if you watch your thoughts. Meditation completely reverses all of that. You sit still. Maybe you're having incense so that your sense of smell is there. Your eyes are closed. You may have covered your ears. You're not moving your body at all. You're trying to let go of all the thoughts, the things you're thinking of. You're replacing it with a mantra. Or if you get into Kriya practice, you're using the breath to sink your consciousness deep into your chakras. You're not even in your physical body. You're trying to go to the astral body, and you're energizing the energy on the astral level and, shifting the way the magnetism is within you. And what happens is that instead of disappearing, you feel more present, more alive, more conscious, more aware than you ever felt just running around in the world grabbing and doing things. And it begins to crack that idea that I am this one, because you find that the sense of individuality and I, and above all the sense of consciousness, can completely transcend everything that you think of as yourself, and yet you're still so completely and solidly there. And when you come out of that, even if the meditation is only medium, a medium meditation, or even a bad meditation, you've directed, you've turned yourself in a completely other direction. And so that when you start, you come back to this one, you're not quite as glued to it, because you know that there's just something else other that's happening. And if you do that regularly and repeatedly, and the power of Kriya is that it unties you from identification with the physical body by releasing the karmic knots that tie you to the physical body, then that freedom that I saw in Swami Kriyananda. Because you see, the thing about Swamiji then and now is that you imagine that if you're not deeply identified with this individuality, that somehow you wouldn't have the same dynamism that you have now. But the example of his life is sent to us because he's so dynamic. He's so present. He's so productive. He's so creative. He's so connected. It's the opposite. The less he's present, the more he's present. And meditation also heightens that, because when you're back in your normal state of consciousness, it's not far away from you. It's just always somewhere vibrating. That you're moving in the midst of a field of consciousness instead of just in this reality. That would be the best way I could say it. And that's why, there's many reasons, but that's why your life can change so much once you start on this path. Because it's not just the hours you spend meditating. It's everything starts directing itself toward that end. And you stay exactly, this is who we think we are, and that part of you remains exactly the same. It's just that you add to it this huge circle around it. And that's how Kriyananda becomes an event for which you're responsible instead of the only reality that you're living in. Does that work?
Okay. Thank you.
Certainly. Is there another question? Any other?
Simple question, ma'am. You've been at this for a very time.
Relatively speaking.
Very young age.
Uh-huh.
And you have reached where you are today.
Right.
And the same would apply to Swamiji.
Uh-huh.
But the question that I've been debating with myself, I come into this this way of life, you can say.
Uh-huh.
Hardly about 5-6 years.
Right.
Before that, it was all mumbo jumbo to me.
Uh-huh.
Is it too late, or is there a way of getting there faster?
Uh-huh. The question has to do with Swamiji met Master at 22. I met Swami Kriyananda at 22, just by divine coincidence. And therefore, I've had the opportunity to, in this body, to spend more years in this body. Is it too late if you're later? Well, Master was very fond of telling a story about a woman in her 80s who came onto the spiritual path when she was in her 80s. And attained God realization, he said. Because when she decided to start, she gave it everything she had. So there's no such thing as, there's really actually no such thing as time. In fact, in one of the comments that Swami Kriyananda makes, one of the commentaries on scripture, he says, we think that God realization takes time because we are hypnotized by the belief that time is a reality. He said, but time itself is an illusion. So the idea that I'm too old or it's too late or I don't have enough time, by its absolute definition, because you're moving into a realm in which there is no time. So it can't be too late to become timeless, if that makes any sense. Now, what you have to recognize, and this is the other real side of it, is... For some people, you know, vitality and mental flexibility wanes as the body ages. But that's not inherent. That's just a habit that we get into. Physical vitality may wane a little bit, but mental flexibility, creativity, originality doesn't have to wane at all. Look at Swamiji. And if we feel like it has waned, we can simply fight against that. And one incarnation is a totally arbitrary piece of time because it's all one continuous flow. And we just have this idea that these incarnations happen sequentially and we don't realize that it's just one, I mean, that they're chopped up as separate events, but they're not separate events. It's one continuous flow of consciousness. It's from the time of our being... spewed out at the beginning of the day of Brahma when Satchidananda threw us out, and don't ask me why, I don't know why, but he threw us out, to the time that we merge back. It's one continuous thread. Just as if right now I'm wearing this, you know, later I'm going to have my pajamas on, tomorrow I'll wear something else. And you wouldn't call those separate incarnations. You would just call this continuous consciousness changing its clothes. So from where we sit, we're so identified with our bodies, we think that when we take off our bodies, something actually happens. Swami Kriyananda on many occasions has said passionately, nothing happens when you die. Nothing happens. Nothing happens that makes any difference because the consciousness we have continues. And we step out of our body as readily as we step out of our clothes. So even the thought that this body is old and I'm not going to be in it that much longer, and therefore my consciousness is going to be limited or defined or my spiritual potential, that's just this part of the same delusion. Wherever you're standing, push yourself toward the light with as much energy and dynamism as you are able to muster. When the term of this incarnation is over, that dynamism will just simply keep going. And there really won't be any point as far as your consciousness is concerned. As far as your limited ego identified with the body, maybe. But if you have shifted your identification even a little bit away from your body into your consciousness, you'll just keep going. And you'll enter another body and you'll play through being a child and you'll just keep going. Yes.
By the way, this will go to next incarnation, as you said. Only if you're human in the next incarnation.
Well, you'll go on in the same way only if you're human. The reincarnation is not whimsical. And there's no, Master said, once you reach the human level, you remain on the human level. And the only reason you would not remain on the human level is if you are so evil that you might have to get thrown back. But he said, even if you get thrown back into an animal, which would be a kind of a punishment because part of you would know you used to be much more than that, he said it would usually only be for one lifetime or so. Although he did say that you could get thrown, you could get thrown back to the level of a germ if you're that bad and then have to come all the way up from there. But as a rule, once we reach the human level, we stay there. But for this reason, this is how Swami explains it in the Raja Yoga course. It's very interesting. We incarnate in the body that has the capacity to express the level of consciousness that we have attained. Okay, a lizard has a certain state of consciousness. You know, it likes to lie in the sun, and if it has a long tongue, every so often it likes to flick out and get an insect. It really can't learn foreign languages. You know, it can't travel to Europe. I'm going to stop completely and tell you this joke that I saw. It was a commercial, and the commercial is a goldfish swimming around in a small goldfish bowl. And it's just swimming. This is like a real film. And it's swimming. This is an advertisement. It's swimming. It looks really happy. And then you realize, you see the shadow, that there's a cat creeping up to the goldfish bowl. And the cat is leering over, and then the cat raises its hand, and you can see the cat's about to grab the goldfish out. And you're becoming a little worried. You become attached to this goldfish. Finally, the goldfish opens its mouth, and it goes, woof! Like that. The cat, of course, is totally freaked out and runs away. And then it's an advertisement for the Berlitz Language School. Learn the benefits of knowing a second language. I thought so too. Fabulous. In fact, however, to come back to where we are, the goldfish doesn't have the capacity to know. It doesn't even know it's a goldfish, what to speak of knowing that if it makes a sound like a dog, the cat's going to get scared. I mean, all those take very sophisticated understandings. And if you have more sophisticated understandings than can be expressed through a goldfish body, you get to be a cat or a dog or whatever. It keeps going. The human body, the nervous system, what makes the human the highest species is it has the most sophisticated nervous system. This nervous system is capable, this is how Master explains it, of perceiving infinity. And the whales and the dolphins can't do that. That's what makes the human the highest species. Not that we do, but we can. That's why a master can live in an ordinary human body, but the nervous system is sophisticated enough to perceive infinity. So as Swami explains it in Raja Yoga, we, our individual consciousness, incarnates in the body that has the capacity to express the consciousness we have. And so that's how we move through the animal levels. And he says the movement is automatic. But by the time you've reached the human level, especially after you've been a human for a while, he says when you first transition, you can go back and forth a little. But your consciousness is simply too sophisticated to go back into an animal body. And so you wouldn't be magnetized to it. Your chakras are too evolved. And the magnetism of those would just simply not make an animal body. It would make another human body, because that's the way it has to go. But see, once you're in a human body, you can just fritter it away. You can fritter a lot of incarnations away. And you can go back, as I said, if you're really evil. You can really get thrown back, Yogananda said. But you won't just randomly go back. Oh, now I'm a goat, the next time I'm a lion, then I'm the king of Prussia, then I'm a scullery maid in England. It's progressive, because nothing happens when you take off your body. Your consciousness is still exactly the same, and then over time, it assumes the form that appropriately expresses it, you see. And that determines all your karma. Swamiji talked once about being besieged by a group of beggars in Calcutta, and one among them, he said, just had a child, a girl child. He said she had a totally different consciousness than all the other beggars, and I'm sure he was looking at her with intuition. And she was sort of standing there with this look on her face like, how did I get here? And he said she looked to him like someone of wealth who had been so selfish with her wealth that she had lost it completely and had to be as poor as a beggar because she had something she really had to learn. But some of her, which made the experience more exquisite for her karmic learning, part of her just knew that this was not her reality, really. But she had, it's what she needed to manifest now because she had not merited the generosity that life had given her, so she'd lost it. And then you see somebody who's extremely fortunate in everything they do, and you think, oh, how lucky they are. But as Swami said, you don't see how many lifetimes they work to get that good karma. But then it's the appropriate manifestation of their consciousness now. Does that help? It's a very important point, because there's a lot of wrong understanding on those points, east and west. Okay, anything else before we... Last one, last, then it's over. Pardon me? How do you get good karmas? Good karma I would define in this sense not... People think of good karma as ease and pleasure. If I'm not challenged, if I get what I want, if I don't have to struggle, people call that good karma. Good karma is the opportunity to expand your consciousness and to grow closer to God. Now, sometimes that's ease and pleasure, and sometimes that's very, very difficult. But good karma is that which allows you to grow closer to God. The fact is, therefore, everything is good karma. But how can you grow closer to God is by making a sincere effort and by asking, praying for the grace to be able to do that. And then, self-evidently, by following divine principles, doing that, making that your priority, no matter whether you have 50 years to do it or 5 years to do it. Make that your priority. Ask in every situation, God, how can I draw closer to you? How can I serve you? Then you let go of all those limiting realities. And when you live in that reality, the conditions of your life become much less the definition of your life. And your consciousness becomes your definition. And that's good karma. Okay? It's a short answer. The enjoyment of this evening is that we are going to be together, those of you who choose to be, for several more times. We just, Mickey, I was going to look for Mickey, he's not sitting there now, but we were just in Calcutta and we had several days of people returning. And it was a wonderful experience. So all of you who have the opportunity to come back, we can build on this, is what I'm meaning to say. So often it's just this and then it's over, but we'll have more time, yeah, to expand on everything we've talked about tonight. So God bless you. Thank you very much.